Christina Martini and Rich Linkoff. You know what time it is. Welcome to Legal Face Off. Two lawyers trading jab for jab. So hit them up with any questions you have.
Welcome to Legal Face Off, WGN Radio and WGNRadio.com. The Legal Eagles are here, Rich Linkoff and Tina Martini. Hi.
Hello.
Hello. How are you?
Thank you so much for joining us.
It's so nice to meet you both. We'll talk to mayoral candidate Bob Fioretti today about his mayoral candidacy. Kellen Hunt Muse will get us up to date on the consent decree for the Chicago Police Department, what that means for officers on the street. Jennifer Blagg has the latest on former Chicago police officer Jason Van Dyke. Then the legal grab bag at the end of the show. We lead things off with Chicago mayoral candidate Bob Fioretti. He's a former Second Ward alderman and an attorney serving on the Judicial Evaluation Committee for the Chicago Bar Association Executive Committee. That is a lot. That's a mouthful.
Right.
Bob, welcome to Legal Face Off.
Good to be here. Thank you.
Bob, as you heard from Pam, one of the issues that we'll be covering later in the show is the consent decree that was recently signed by a federal judge. We've covered the Laquan McDonald trial extensively. That's in the news today because Jason Van Dyke, his wife is reporting that he was beaten in prison. There's a lot going on in this city dealing with crime and with police relations. What would be your plans if elected mayor to deal with that issue?
Well, first of all, when we deal with crime, the issue, we have to be looking at a holistic approach, reopening our mental health, making sure our police officers have a sufficient number. Our detective division has sufficient number to start solving the crimes and the problems that are on our streets. And then we also have to look at opening up our own crime lab. Last year, about 4,000 cases were dismissed by the Illinois State Police because they couldn't get their analysis done on the crime work in time for court cases, so they were thrown out. 4,000 cases that affect the people of the city of Chicago. But, you know, when you talk about the consent decree, I've always been, and it's unfortunate, it's here, it's going to be done, but the real issue should have been from day one. If we had a professional running the police department, a professional, not somebody who's now in a divorce mode with his former boss, and is now saying we should have an investigation, well, if we would have had a professional, it boils down to four simple areas. One, how we hire. And I've always been for a diversified police force. I got criticized by people in 2007, the other alderman, because I was calling for a diversified police department. Secondly, it's how we train them. And we need to train them over and over and over again. The tension and the issues are too difficult of police officers. We've had six known and possibly a seventh suicide out there by police officers. They have problems too. Third, which is the biggest problem that we have, lack of supervision. You know, Van Dyke should never have happened. The whole issue of Laquan McDonald should never have happened. It could have been avoided. You know, you look at somebody who's got several civil rights suits, and yes, we can talk about it, and being lawyers, that sometimes people file things for money, but you know what? After your first one or second one, you pull the person in. What are you doing here? How come they're not being trained properly? And then look at what his history is. Is he having marital problems, financial problems, drinking problems? Does that individual need mental health? That's what proper supervision embodies. And then finally, it's a matter of discipline, how we discipline. You know, it took me quite a while, 2.5 years, to push through the Police Reform Act that was necessary. We have a candidate now who is the head of the head of the police board, but where was she? I mean, when I was raising these issues, she was silent too. She was because she was employed by what? Daly and Rahm. And now she's the big police reform advocate and beats her chest. Come on, give me a break. So those are the things that I look at here.
So there are a lot of other issues to talk about, but just to round this out, how effective do you think the consent decree will be in combating a lot of the issues that you just mentioned?
Well, you know, there are some Again, it doesn't direct its attention towards the police officer, him or herself. It doesn't help them out in the street. Yes, we have crisis intervention teams. We talk about other items. You know, they talk about the chokehold, the biggest flaw. Everybody's talking about it, the flaw in it. Well, I drafted a special order, general order that dealt with abolishing the chokehold here in the city of Chicago under Harold Washington's administration. I don't know whatever happened with that. It's long gone. Why did they take that off? Who took it off? I mean, those are the things that we ought to be looking at. I think the consent decree, it's not going to bring down crime. I mean, let's face facts. There is a code of silence, but it exists in the community. I mean, a 15% clearance rate, and all we're seeing is problems out there. Is not going to, when the code of silence is broken in the president of the county board's office, who covers up on theft of her vehicles, sexual harassment, then we may see a breakthrough. Well, I don't see, until the community comes forward, look, we had a one-year-old shot, and people ought to know that the mother was the intended target, and nobody's coming forward. Give me a break.
Bob, let's move to city politics and specifically corruption in city politics.
In this city?
Shocking. Shocking.
Shocking.
But if elected, you would take over a city council that is rife with corruption right now, right? We know the Alderman Burke situation being investigated by the feds. Danny Solis wore a wiretap. He's being investigated. Rick Munoz has had issues. You served alongside all of these people. What would you do from day one if elected mayor to fix these issues that are giving us a terrible name around the country and the world?
Well, I've said from day one that ethics starts at the top. I would have made sure that we would have had a tougher, and I introduce every reform measure and that all these candidates talk about, from term limits now, smaller city council, getting rid of aldermanic privilege, especially disclosing conflicts of interest on your votes. I've already been talking about, and I introduced those kind of resolutions or ordinances in the city. And all of a sudden, all these candidates are now embracing every reform idea I have. And I'm glad they're getting on the Fioretti train. But you know what? We've got to, I think we need a tough inspector general just for the city council if we're going to have 50. I mean, the current inspector general, I mean, granted, he finds a garbage man here or there, and I say garbage man, a streets and sand worker, sanitation worker here or there, somebody in the water department here or there, but he's never gone after the alderman. You know, we also have another, the 20th ward alderman is awaiting his trial. I mean, who's kidding who on what? Getting rid of, I mean, having term limits brings this problem to a lesser degree. Getting rid of the size of the city council also. But at the same time, this aldermanic privilege where you have to go to the alderman for a driveway permit, a sign permit, it invites corruption. And corruption, it breeds contempt of their citizens. And that's what we're seeing with the Burke Four, especially the Preckwinkles, the Dailies, the Mendozas, and the Chicos. They're all bound into this whole system of a corrupt, politically influenced campaign financing system that they are all people who grew out of that.
Speaking
and by
of,
the way, I should say I never took. I gave back my first year in office over $100,000 to developers because I didn't want them to influence me. And later on, I found out people who were lobbyists. I started giving money back to the lobbyists because lobbyists control City Hall.
So this race has seen an unprecedented number of people, many of whom you just rattled off. What do you think it is about this particular election that has brought so many people into the race? Many people who obviously have renown and who have been involved in governmental politics and city politics for many years.
Well, I think, you know, people see it as transformational and what can be done for the city. I hope whoever wins that they take one good idea, and some of them I have shallow ideas of what they're proposing. But if one good idea to move this city forward, because our biggest problem, we can talk about crime, we can talk about education, but until we solve the pension problem, that will chip away on everything we do. And the pension problem, who's ever sworn in as mayor from May 15th to September 1st, has to find $400 million new dollars to solve the problem, and $600 the year after that, $800 after that, $1 billion. We will be paying $2 billion into our pension programs the way the neglect that has happened under many of the Burke Four and who have advocated some of these items, pension holidays. And again, I go back to, as you were saying, Ed Burke opposed me on every reform item in the city council. But we must solve the pension problem, or otherwise we're doomed.
And how does Bob Fioretti solve the pension problem? We've heard a lot of ideas from your opponents. What is it going to look like? People don't want their taxes raised, and then you can't be unfair to retirees, make them carry the whole burden. You can't be unfair to the workers who are currently earning the money that pays the taxes. So what do you do?
Well, those ideas, many of them that you're hearing, I've already proposed long ago from 2010 to deal with changes in the pension system and not to affect the workers, and making sure that pension is a problem. How about a promise? It is a problem, but it is a promise to our workers. And I have to say this because, I'm in favor of commuter tax. 6 years ago, I proposed it. 1% on the 800,000 people that come from the suburbs, Indiana, Wisconsin, would generate $300 million for the city. It won't kill jobs, contrary to the ROM beat and the Tribune beat. It won't kill jobs. Secondly, we have to look at lifting the ban on video poker. I've said that for quite a while. Now about four or five of these candidates and some of the aldermanic ones, that will generate $75 million. You know, we can cut down on how we're dealing with overtime. I proposed a grid system that was going to be effective. Ron realized that my idea had some merit. He put a half grid system, and I'm going to use it. I didn't want to say certain words on it, but it only saved about $20 million. It could have saved $70 million. There are things in the budget that we can save. We get past, we can easily do the first year. I will tell you, we have to work with Washington. We're going to have to work with expanding our tax base, bringing in jobs, new people to make sure we expand our tax base. Here we have to work with Springfield. We hear all kinds of ideas. You know, marijuana is not going to produce much money for this city. Maybe $5, maybe $7 million. It's a drop in the bucket. We can use that to reopen mental health clinics and public health clinics for people in this city. And I will open up the mental health clinics. At the same time, we have to be, you know, constitutional amendments are going to go nowhere. So let's quit kidding ourselves, as the mayor proposed that. And finally, a casino would be helpful. But in 2010, I proposed that, too. And this is now 2019, and we're still waiting. And the people up in Des Plaines who own that casino will fight to make sure we don't get it, because they don't want to take it away from their profits up there.
Thank you, Bob Fioretti.
Uh-oh, too short. It was great to be here, though, for everybody.
Thanks so much for having us.
We'd love to have you for longer. When you're elected, you'll have to come back and spend a little more time with us.
I will. Thank you.
You are listening to Christina Martini on Legal Face-Off. Tina is a partner at McDermott, Will & Emery and focuses her practice on domestic and international trademark and copyright law, as well as domain name, internet, social media, advertising, and unfair competition law. Tina has received numerous professional accolades, including an AV preeminent rating by Martindale Hubble and being selected for many years as one of America's leading intellectual property attorneys by various legal publications, including Chambers & Partners and World Trademark Review. Tina is also the recipient of the Anti-Defamation League's Women of Achievement Award and has been recognized by Crain's Chicago Business as one of Chicago's most influential minority lawyers. In addition to her full-time practice, Tina is an author, columnist, legal analyst, and podcast host, and she frequently shares her thought leadership with respect to current issues and trends impacting both the legal and business landscapes through various media outlets. McDermott, Will & Emery is an integrated international law firm. McDermott has an uncompromising commitment to legal excellence, extraordinary client service, and a high-performance culture. It is committed to helping clients achieve stellar legal and business results today and well into the future. To contact Tina and to learn more about McDermott, Will & Emery, visit MWE.com.
Welcome back to Legal Face-Off. Right now we're talking with Special Litigation Counsel Kathy Hunt-Muse, who is Special Litigation Counsel at ACLU of Illinois. Thank you so much for joining us.
Thanks for having me.
So, Kathy, earlier this month, U.S. District Judge Robert Dow Jr. approved the consent decree that drives many changes that are intended to improve the Chicago Police Department. What are the initial reactions to the finalization of the consent decree?
That's right. On January 31st, the consent decree was approved. And I think that we've heard across the city a lot of relief and happiness that finally this process is going forward, and the conversations have been had publicly and by lots of politicians at this point, and we've had all of the investigative reports, and we now finally have a plan in place. It won't become effective just yet until the monitor gets appointed in the next couple of weeks, but we have a starting point within the horizon now.
Kathy, a couple of the key points of the consent decree that was signed by Judge Dow are that officers will have to report incidents in which they point their guns at people. They're not allowed to use a taser to shock someone who's simply running away. They'll have to render first aid to people that are hurt by officers' use of force. They will have to have at least one sergeant for every 10 officers on every watch in every district. Which of those do you think is most important? And on the flip side, where do you think the biggest blowback will come from the officers? Because obviously, as we've heard, many officers have an issue with this consent decree and feel that it will neuter their ability to do their job. So how do you feel on both of those sides of the issue?
I think that all of the reforms that you named are incredibly important, and I think with any of these reforms, some of it's going to come into how they get implemented, and sometimes if they get implemented in a way that doesn't feel like it gets the officers' buy-in or just make things unduly cumbersome, that could become a source of tension unnecessarily. But I think that what's important for the public to know is that this consent decree was negotiated over a long period of time, and during those negotiations, police officers were involved in drafting the documents and down to the T. So though it might not have been welcomed by all parts of the department and everything, that these reforms were designed with the police department at the table and starting to think through how these things would work. I think some of them are kind of more obvious to me about how officers are really going to benefit from. Like, for example, you mentioned that there's a real focus on making sure that there's a appropriate supervision ratio for officers. So one of the findings of the Department of Justice when they released their report on the Chicago Police Department was that the supervision ratio was incredibly high in Chicago. While a best practice would be to have one supervisor over 10 officers, in some places it was 1 to 25 in Chicago. And so that really changes the nature of what that supervision can be and what it can look like. And I think that makes it more difficult for supervisors to provide meaningful supervision, and then it makes it harder for the officers to get guidance from their supervisors. So I think that while there might be a knee-jerk reaction that if the ACLU or other groups like that are urging for reforms, that officers aren't going to like them. But I think that if we kind of step away from those talking points and think about how these reforms got created, I think that they should have gone a lot further than they did. But a lot of them were really informed by what officers need to do their jobs more effectively and safely, which is what we all want.
So taking one of the other points that Richard mentioned earlier about officers needing to report incidents in which they point their guns at people, apparently that was one of the more controversial parts of the consent decree. Can you walk us through why it was such a sticking point and whether there's a belief that there will be truthful reporting around that?
So I can't speak to exactly why it was controversial at the negotiating table because I wasn't there for those conversations, and to the extent it was controversial, it became public that was a part that the Attorney General and the City of Chicago could not agree on. And the consent decree is a settlement of a lawsuit, and initially they thought that might not be something we can settle. They were able to come to an agreement on it, but I think that there is a concern that we saw get highlighted publicly where the Attorney General, just like the Department of Justice and others, have noted that the use of force is evident when you're pointing a gun at somebody. That is an incredibly traumatizing thing to happen to somebody, and it should not be done casually or lightly when it doesn't need to be done. And we can't know how often that is happening, how often that kind of force is happening, if there's no reason why an officer ever has to mention, oh, I pointed my gun in someone's face today. So some of that is that side of the perspective. And then I think of the other thing, not speaking for the city, but I think that what I've heard in the media is officers concerned that it's more paperwork. To the point about truthful reporting, I think that is something that the monitor is going to really need to be honed in on all of these things. And when the data and the reporting is coming to the monitor needs to be looking for ways to check that. Can we look at videos? Can we do audit checks? Because we don't want this process to be a rubber stamp and fake, and make sure that the actual behavior on the streets is changing, not just the data about what's happening is changing.
And you talk a little bit about buy-in. How do you legally get this group of officers used to doing things one way to suddenly change and abide by the terms discussed in the consent decree?
So that's going to differ for each aspect of the reform. And, it's a comprehensive document. So whenever you talk about a specific reform, for example, like when to use a taser, that's going to have to change in a written policy. It's going to have to be something that the officers get trained on that new policy. And then it's going to have to be something that they're supervised and looked at to see if that's changing. So it's not a matter of just changing something and writing and putting on a website and the problem is solved. I think that one reason why this takes a while to happen is that officers need to go through that training, and we have to see supervision, and we have to see if the training worked and the new policy worked to actually get to the goal of why that reform was in the consent decree in the first place.
Okay. Thank you so much. Kathy Hunt Muse, special counsel at ACLU of Illinois. Thanks for joining us.
Thanks for having me.
Comp Alliance is unique in the workers' compensation industry in their ability to provide comprehensive managed care services from initiation of a claim to settlement, including 24/7 nurse triage, URAC accredited medical and vocational case management. Their suite of innovative MSP compliance solutions, including fully customizable MSA programs, professional administration, and additional cost avoidance services, simplifies the claims management process. Their focus is retaining accountability, responsiveness, and quality while tailoring their services to meet your needs. For your managed care support needs, contact Comp Alliance online at compalliance.com. Again, compalliance.com.
Welcome back to Legal Face Off. Right now we have attorney Jennifer Blagg. She has her own practice. She's had that Blagg Law since 2008, handling criminal law. She was part of a team representing Jason Van Dyke at his sentencing hearing, and now also his appellate attorney. Thank you so much for joining us, Jennifer.
My pleasure.
Jennifer, on Monday, Joseph McMahon, who was the special prosecutor assigned to prosecute your client, had a press conference along with newly elected State Attorney General Kwame Raoul. And that press conference was to announce that they are seeking a harsher sentence for Jason Van Dyke, who is, of course, convicted of second-degree murder in the 2014 shooting death of Laquan McDonald. Tell us why you think this request is a bad idea.
So it's not that it's a bad idea necessarily, it's just an incorrect idea. So a writ of mandamus is an extraordinary remedy that should only be used in certain circumstances. This isn't one of those circumstances. Basically, not to get too legal on you, but what they're arguing is that Judge
we're called Legal Face Off, by the way.
Do what?
I said we are called Legal Face Off, so it's okay.
I know, but you can really get into the murky stuff.
Absolutely. No, we appreciate that.
And this is one of those cases, actually. So they're arguing that his sentence is illegal. That's the premise behind their argument. And my understanding of law, my reading of the law, is something, in order for something to be illegal, it has to be the violation of a statute. There's no statute at issue here that Judge Gahan's order did not comport with. So it was a discretionary matter in sentencing. But the thrust of their argument is there's this case, People v. Lee. And People v. Lee said, basically, if you look at it in a simple fashion, that aggravated battery is a more serious offense than second-degree murder because it has a higher sentence. So what they're arguing is Judge Gahan did not follow People v. Lee, and therefore Jason should be sentenced to aggravated battery, right? That argument totally ignores the arguments we presented to Judge Gahan and a whole line of Supreme Court cases that basically says if someone's convicted of second-degree murder, they have to be sentenced on that count and not something like aggravated battery, because otherwise it creates a nullity of second-degree murder, and you can't do that because it contravenes legislative intent.
Well, and also, I mean, besides all that, it just doesn't make sense, right? I mean, just to the average layperson, forget everything you said, which makes total sense, by the way, but to the average layperson, how can second-degree battery be more serious than killing somebody?
Right. And obviously, the answer to that Kwame Raoul would say is because the Supreme Court said so, right?
They didn't really say that, though.
Well, that really wasn't the question presented in People v. Lee. That, like I said, it's a simplified view of the case. But in reality, in People v. Lee, the defendant got a larger sentence on second-degree murder and a lesser sentence on ag bat. So it was the state presenting the arguments to the court, and the state was arguing that he should be sentenced to second-degree murder in that case. So, and they did not present any of the arguments that we presented to Judge Gahan as to why you should be sentenced to second-degree murder, which is legislative intent, separation of powers, proportionate penalties. We presented a lot of arguments, you know, and so People v. Lee didn't address that, and I don't think People v. Lee controls for that reason.
So right now we're waiting essentially because they've asked for the state Supreme Court to send the case back to Judge Gahan for resentencing. Just so our listeners have some sense as to what the timeline of something like that looks like, what is the timeline? And what we'd also like to do is get your thoughts as to the latest backdrop here, which is that Jason Van Dyke's wife had a press conference earlier today. It hit the news yesterday that he was beaten badly in federal prison, the federal prison to which he was recently transferred. So what can we expect procedurally, and what happens with Jason Van Dyke in prison in the meantime?
Okay, so let's first talk about the writ, right? So we have 7 days after the filing of the AG and special prosecutor's request for writ to file an objection. So we will be filing an objection. Then after that, the Supreme Court can order briefing or they can deny the request. There is no timetable listed in the rules, the Supreme Court rules, about when the Supreme Court will respond, will deny, or whatever action they request. So we don't know. I don't think it would be a long time, but we just don't know. So do you have any more questions on that front?
No. I mean, that's really helpful to hear that, just so our listeners have a sense of what that will look like.
Right. And in the meantime, we filed a notice of appeal on Friday because we learned that they were going to be filing the writ of mandamus just to ensure that Jason's appellate rights are preserved in case something comes up in the Supreme Court proceedings that we believe we should be able to argue on appeal was incorrect. It really does open up a Pandora's box of legal issues, because we believe that Jason should have never been allowed to be charged with the counts of aggravated battery. Those counts were brought a long, long, long time after Jason was originally charged with first-degree murder. So we believe it violated a principle called compulsory joinder. Obviously, we wouldn't argue that on appeal right now because he got sentenced to second-degree murder, right? But if the Supreme Court says, well, he should have been sentenced on aggravated battery, then that creates an opening for us to raise that argument. So it gets really complicated.
Jennifer, how much of this is legal, truly substantive legal argument versus political? You know, Kwame Raoul, who's, by the way, been on our show, is newly elected, right? It's a high-profile mm-hmm. office. He was preceded by a high-profile AG and Lisa Madigan. Many are seeing Kwame Raoul as a future, you know, senatorial, gubernatorial candidate, maybe even, you know, presidential candidate one day. How much do you think that this is done for politics versus the actual substantive legal basis behind it?
I think it's largely political. If you look at the special prosecutor's comments right after Judge Gahn sentenced Jason, he indicated that he thought the sentence was fair and didn't plan to take any further action.
Okay.
The more there was an outcry from citizens, I believe two law schools wrote a letter to Raul urging him to file mandamus. Several other things happened. And so I think it was a very political response, especially in light of the fact that what we talked about earlier, basically, that it's not an illegal sentence and mandamus really isn't the appropriate remedy.
And one of the things that we learned in the past 24 hours, at least I learned in the past 24 hours, that was that Jason Van Dyke was being moved from where he was being held in Illinois to Connecticut. Is that normal procedure, or do you know anything about why that happened?
I don't know anything about why it happened, because the Illinois Department of Corrections never shares information on when someone's being moved or why they're being moved, generally speaking, right? And they shouldn't, because it's a security concern. Especially in Jason's case, I think it was important that the public not know where he was being housed, right? Because of the security concerns we had. In regard to, is it common for someone to be to be moved from state custody to federal custody? It's certainly not common, but it's not out of the realm of possibility. The Tribune talked about how Drew Peterson was moved to federal custody. I had another client who initiated a hunger strike at Menard that was moved into federal custody. So it's unusual, but not totally out of the norm.
Okay. Thank you very much. Attorney Jennifer Blagg, thank you so much for joining us this afternoon.
Sure.
Rich Lenkoff is an insurance defense attorney with Bryce Downey & Lenkoff. Rich is consistently recognized by clients for his outstanding litigation results. In 2015, Target named him their top outside litigation attorney in the country. Rich has received a number of industry accolades, including Illinois Super Lawyer from 2015 through 2018 and Leading Lawyer from 2012 through 2018, designations given to less than 5% of Illinois attorneys. Rich is also an active member of his community, including serving on the Lincoln Park High School Local School Council, the Advisory Board of Legal Prep Charter Academy, and the Board of Visitors for the Northern Illinois University College of Law. In addition to his full-time legal practice, Rich is a producer with credits, including 85, The Greatest Team in Football History, starring former President Barack Obama, Bill Murray, and Mike Ditka, and Renegades, a live show production at Caesar's Palace in Las Vegas, starring Terrell Owens, Jose Canseco, and Jim McMahon. In addition to co-hosting Legal Faceoff since 2013, Rich is the legal analyst for several WGN shows, including The Bill and Wendy Show and Patty Vasquez with Andrea Darlis. Bryce Downey & Lenkoff is a full-service litigation firm practicing general liability, workers' compensation, professional liability, business transactions, construction law, and intellectual property. For more information about Rich and Bryce Downey & Lenkoff, please visit bdlfirm.com.
And now the way we close every show, dipping into the legal grab bag. With us today, Char Dalton, General Counsel and Vice President at Seco Logistics. Did I get that right?
Seco Logistics.
I knew I wasn't going to get that right. Her expertise is in the transportation industry. And Jeff Carlin, Executive Producer of The Ro Con Show with Anna DeVlantis here on WGN Radio.
Got that right.
Welcome to the show. Yeah, well, you know.
It is Jeff, right? Pronounced Jeff?
Yeah, Jeff.
I've said that a time or two. Thanks for joining us. First up, El Chapo, the Mexican crime lord known as El Chapo, was convicted on Tuesday after a 3-month drug trial in New York. This guy, he kind of even has a name that kind of just is legendary. It sounds legendary, right?
I want a name that begins with L.
Al?
Be cool just to have that as my nickname.
Yeah, I'll work on that for our next show,
just,
Rich.
It's cool. It's like badass.
El Chapo, because it's the guy.
Exactly.
Yeah. Well, I think it translates to like shorty.
Shorty. Okay.
I don't want that one.
He's only 5'7".
You don't want that, Rich? You don't
I'm called
call
short enough as it is without confirming it in Spanish.
So, El Chapo. So he's been a star of many a legal grab bag for us over the past few months. So as Pam mentioned, after jury deliberations that lasted for more than a week and a 3-month-long drug trial in New York and testimony from 56 witnesses, 14 of whom worked with El Chapo, he was found guilty on all 10 counts of the indictment. So the verdict brings an end to a long chapter. I won't say it brings an end to the saga, but it brings an end to a long chapter in the saga, which began 25 years ago when El Chapo was blamed for the assassination of a Roman Catholic cardinal at the Guadalajara.
Or does it bring an end?
Dun, dun, dun.
He's been known to break out of many jails.
Yes, I know. I don't know. I got to tell you, my bet's on El Chapo every time.
Oh, yeah.
So, you know, there have been jailbreaks. It is truly a telenovela of epic proportions between the jailbreaks, hiding from law enforcement for years on end, being caught, escaping, and then being re-caught. Until in 2016, he was arrested after a gunfight in Mexico and then was extradited to Brooklyn, where he had originally been indicted in 2009. After all of this, I'm still betting on El Chapo.
Sure. The prosecutor said that it sends a message that you're not unreachable, you're not untouchable, and your day will come. Mm-hmm. Do you think in this day and age, this will have any effect on the massive drug trade that exists in Mexico, in our country, all over the place?
Yeah, I think it certainly sends a message that the war on drugs is still you know, alive and well, and that, you know, folks like El Chapo can be brought down. I think, unfortunately, as Tina mentioned, my money might be on El Chapo because this story reads a lot like The Godfather. And when I read that he's escaped from prisons with mistresses naked through tunnels, and then there was another part of this in Mexico where he escapes from the back of his Cabo home, perhaps this was the nude story where he runs nude through a valley of thorn bushes and escapes.
I'm sorry, I would just have to stay locked up.
You can't make it up. Jeff, what are your thoughts on this? You cover this on the
show, all over it. My favorite part of the whole thing, the saga here, is the Chicago connection to the Empire carpet jingle. I don't know if anybody...
588.
Exactly.
2300.
What's the connection? Yeah. So the story goes that one of El Chapo's high-ranking underlings used to have to set up all these burner phones, and to test them, he would call that number because it's the only number he knew in Chicago he could remember from his time in Chicago.
Wow.
And so he says this number out in court, and of course, in taking place in Brooklyn, nobody there picked up on it, but Chicago media was like, there it is, and every reporter was humming in the head.
Let's have been before the Luna commercials were on high rotation.
Let's all do the Empire together. 1, 2, 3.
588-2300 Empire today.
We were thinking the same thing. That's hilarious.
So that's my favorite little nugget from that whole saga.
Amazing.
I have an Empire guy bobblehead because I met the former GC of Empire. And
Is that a real guy?
He's a real guy. And I actually knew somebody who knew him growing up. But this general counsel of Empire brought for all her co-panelists a little bobblehead of the Empire carpet man.
Wow. That guy gets so around. Cool. She's everywhere.
Where's my WGN bobblehead?
Yeah. Right? We're working on it.
Rich, I got to get a bobblehead.
Budgetary cutbacks. Budgets.
I can get you a pen, though, Char.
Yeah. I'll take it.
There, hang on. There you go. All right.
All right. Next up, the former Renault Nissan boss, Carlos Ghosn, not getting a golden parachute now from the French car maker he worked for failing to be present at Renault. Renault said its board agreed to withdraw the $25.9 million he was owed in deferred and performance pay. So this guy can't stay out of trouble.
Yeah, Ghosn, one of the most high-profile CEOs I think ever arrested. He's now in jail in Japan. They don't quite have the due process laws that we enjoy here in the United States because he's been locked up. He's asked to see his lawyer. He's finally getting a lawyer that he can see, but he hasn't had many visitors. He hasn't had many chances to confer with his lawyer. He hired this new guy who's nicknamed the Razor in Japan, who has had many high-profile cases in Japan. He has secured many not guilty verdicts for many controversial defendants. As you mentioned, he will not get his deferred compensation. I thought it was interesting that his former lawyer maybe didn't know all of the criminal laws of Japan very well, because there was an issue about wearing an ankle bracelet if he was granted bail. He agreed to wear the ankle bracelet until we learned that Japan has no system for monitoring ankle bracelets.
Wow.
Maybe a small detail seriously you would want to work out if you were his lawyer. Maybe that's one of the reasons he's no longer his lawyer and he hired the Razor.
Well, yeah, I actually think that's going to be your nickname, Rich. El Razor.
But wait a second. Isn't Japan like... Didn't they invent Sony Walkmans?
That's what I was going to say.
How could they not monitor ankle bracelets?
I was totally... Oh, wow. That's amazing.
Jeff, what do you think of this? Should this guy rot in a Japanese jail for a while? What he did is pretty serious, right? He had an elaborate fraud scheme over the course of many years while running one of the biggest auto companies on Earth.
Sure. I mean, I'm all for due process, but there are lots of people in his power rankings and people taking advantage of the poor and the less fortunate who I'd like to just be, oh, yeah, we had to lock him up for 6 months, been 10 years, whatever, just because it was such a big crime. I'd like to see that. I think we need more of that here.
More of that? Yeah. Shar, you're nodding your head?
I do, too, yeah. So in all sincerity, from a compliance perspective, there has to be accountability from the top down. And when there has been such financial fraud, as in this case, and it's impacting a very large organization, there are a lot of people's employment, there are a lot of shareholders that were affected by this. So I absolutely think that he deserves the time that he's been given and the charges being brought.
Tina, you often consult with clients and discuss on this show your brand protection, your involvement there. Obviously, it's important when you have this kind of charge against the CEO to not just worry about, the impact on the individual, but also on the company and its brand.
That's correct, because when these things come to light, it's really important in order for the company to preserve its brand image and its goodwill with the public to demonstrate that they are able to run their business. And when it's not run the way it should be, particularly when you have shareholders involved, it's critically important to do the right thing, particularly because all eyes are on you.
And right now Renault's saying its revenue is down 2.3% because of it's blaming Nissan's contribution to all that. So
I'm giving up my Renault
car. Right? Whoever drove one
of those. Le Car.
It was
El Razor in Le Car.
Yeah, that would be good luck.
That's perfect.
Have you ever owned a Renault?
I have not.
Nissan?
But I've family who owned a Le Car.
A Le Car.
Yes.
What color? Do you remember?
For some reason, I
feel like
it was
should
like
be
a
green.
Purple. It was like a purplish color.
It literally said Le Car on it.
It said Le Car.
Yeah, I remember that. Everybody wanted one.
I don't even know what it looks like. It sounds like a minivan, though.
I can't remember.
It was bad. It was like a tiny sedan.
It was like a tiny little car.
Yeah. Remember the Lada? My chemistry teacher in high school drove a Lada. Remember that? It was a Russian vehicle.
The only Russian vehicle.
Yeah, it was the only one ever. Yeah. I think they still make them.
Yeah, they still make them.
I don't remember them very much here. Maybe they were...
Because it's a Russian car. That's why you don't remember.
You had to know a guy to get one.
Yeah, exactly.
I have a Nissan, so I really can't. I don't know. I might have a conflict of interest there. Let's move on. Now we're going to talk about immigration. We have 8 immigrant families who were separated at the border last year under a rescinded Trump administration policy, filing claims now for millions of dollars in damages. What do we think? I mean, we've seen the video that's coming from some of these areas along the border where people have been, starving, their kids suffering. What do we think?
Well, I think that it's pretty bad. I mean, when you look at, what's administratively what's going on here is these families filed this complaint because they need to do this. And it's with the Department of Health and Human Services. It's the first necessary step before they can actually sue the federal government. And that won't come for a number of months, but they are claiming severe mistreatment. When you hear the stories and you see the footage, you've got families that are being separated and it's violent physical separation. And any type of separation of children from their families and from their parents is terrible. But then when you look at the mocking that was apparently happening of the parents when it was a very emotional time, of course, and when you look at the fact that they were separated for as long as they were in some cases, these kids and these families are suffering what sounds like PTSD in many ways. It's awful. And, they're claiming from a legal perspective that these life-altering traumas that they've experienced violate their due process rights to family integrity under the Fifth Amendment. And each of the families is seeking $3 million in damages. So it's going to be interesting to see how this plays out. It's terrible.
It is. Is this precedent setting that a group of people would sue for something like this together?
I think that it's going to continue and until there's a reason for them not to, if for some reason they get shot down. But I do think we're going to see more of these.
You have an overwhelming amount of evidence. Okay.
Yeah, no question.
All right. Let's move on to the next topic. We are talking this time former lawyer fugitive. This is the former wife of a disbarred Georgia attorney who allegedly stabbed his mother to death, said she's scared for her and her children's safety now. They've got a manhunt underway for this guy. His name is Richard Merritt, right?
Yeah, Pam, if there's a lawyer convicted of or accused of doing something bad, we will cover it here on Legal Faceoff. That is our, that's our promise to you.
We are the ethics bar.
Absolutely.
Yeah, the ethics board here.
Killing your mom, that's a special kind of crazy.
Not great. Yeah,
allegedly.
Richard Merritt, who had filed multiple medical malpractice claims for clients over the years and then admitted that he pocketed the money that he won. He used the settlements on personal expenses, including vacations. He is the one who is now the subject of this nationwide manhunt. He's allegedly an alcoholic. And his brother just said yesterday that he should give himself up. And begin serving this 15-year sentence for stealing his client's money. Certainly not doing himself any favors by continuing to elude authorities. But yeah, not a great day for the legal bar in Georgia, Tina.
No, not at all. This guy sounds like he's a disaster.
He took off his ankle monitor allegedly.
Back to the ankle monitor.
Apparently, right? Apparently they're working.
Right? They hooked up.
Not really, because that was before he killed his mother allegedly February 2nd and stole her 2009 Lexus.
Yeah, sure. You're a lawyer. What do you think when you see lawyers doing bad things like this? I mean, does it reflect poorly on the entire profession, or is this just an individual bad guy?
You know, I don't think you can take a generalization of somebody killing the mother and apply it to the profession. But, I mean, certainly the legal profession is not immune from criminal acts and certainly people who have, just went off the deep end. And this guy certainly sounds like he falls into that category. The one interesting thing about this story that, to me as I read it, is that his wife had recently, I think they had divorced in 2018, and she claimed that she didn't know about all of the theft and diversion of the client funds. So whenever I read things like that, I just wonder where the disconnect was between the husband and wife. How was there not visibility if they're using the client funds and taking vacations and presumably living above their means? So sounds like there was something a little bit off in that aspect in reading the case. But I think he sounds like he's just, mentally unstable, and hopefully they find him soon.
Jeff, what are your thoughts?
I mean, it sounds like a classless person and a grade A screw up type. I mean, to kill your own mother, like you said, it's a certain type of crazy. I don't know. I don't think lawyers are all the same, just like any other profession. So it doesn't really have an impact on how I see lawyers, but definitely think this guy needs to get caught and caught fast.
It's the kind of thing that makes a good TV show,
yeah.
Right?
I look forward to watching this on Dateline mm-hmm. in the future. Mm-hmm.
Don't watch it alone.
Well, let's see how you feel about lawyers after the next story.
Right. Another lawyer.
Yeah. I mean, speaking of lawyers doing pretty dumb things, Tina, we've got one who was disciplined, rightfully so, for lying, which you don't see that often, actually. The story.
You mean the lying or the discipline?
The discipline. I mean, you see lying.
Because I see a whole lot of lying, Rich.
Exactly. You see it frequently.
You must not have kids.
But, well, not that they're lawyers. But yeah, you see lawyers lie a lot. But I think the one that caught our attention in this case, and by the way, I have to give a shout out to my friend who's a lawyer, Ruby Khalil, mm-hmm. in Omaha, who sent this story to me.
Oh, nice.
So shout out to Ruby. But yeah, what caught our attention is that this guy actually got caught and disciplined, which is good news.
It is good news. I don't like people who lie and get away with it. So last week in New York, this former associate in a law firm who had lied to a partner on numerous occasions was suspended for 3 months. So Dennis McCoubry is the associate, and he was charged by the bar counsel for engaging in fraud, neglecting a legal matter, and engaging in conduct that reflected adversely on his fitness to practice law. So just to kind of give a sense as to what we're talking about for our listeners here, he was asked to draft an appellate brief by a partner, which he did, but then he filed it without telling the partner that he had filed it. And when he was asked about it, he gave the partner what he claimed to be a draft, which was actually a fake draft. The partner then edited the fake draft and didn't come clean to the partner until the partner actually figured it out and confronted him. In another incident, McCoubry was asked to print, serve, and file an appellate brief. He printed it, but he didn't serve it, and he didn't file it. And after he realized his mistake, he then served it and filed it, but then he jumped through a lot of hoops to conceal his wrongdoing, including writing a fake reply brief and making up this whole email exchange with, it was like a fake exchange with opposing counsel. He got caught doing this. And the good news, I guess.
This is also known as every day at my law.
Wow.
Just kidding.
But I guess the good news for McCoubry, if there is any good news to this story, is that he received a shorter suspension than he otherwise would have gotten because no one was hurt, technically. He had a relatively clean professional record otherwise, and he had a terminally ill parent during the course of all these
Oh, well, then you should have said so. Well, then it's okay.
Yeah, then it's okay, right?
Oh, my God. This stuff is crazy. I mean, Shar, you've worked with young attorneys over the years. Used to be in private practice. Do you see this stuff go on? I mean, I've seen some of this kind of thing go on. I have obviously zero tolerance, as we all do, but it's crazy. Is this a generational thing, or is it just gone on forever? Or what's the deal?
Well, it's definitely
what's with
hard.
These young people? Get off my lawn.
It's hard to find good talent. I will start with that, but this takes it to an extreme because this person went to such tremendous lengths to file phony briefs and sort of cover his tracks as opposed to owning up to it. So I think that's definitely outside the norm of what even as you say, the millennials.
Jeff, answer for your generation now. Explain.
It's funny because it's the idea that covering the crime is worse than the crime
exactly.
itself. I mean, that always comes down to, and I don't think a lot of people, you know, in the younger generation really fully appreciate that.
Yeah, it seemed like, one of those, it reminded me of Fargo when it just like, he just kept trying to cover up and it just got worse
right.
and worse.
That's a great movie.
I mean, this guy just kept trying to, you know, fix the issue and dug himself deeper and thankfully got caught. So there's a happy ending to this story.
Most people would think the happy ending was that the price of the crime was not as high, but I'm with you, Rich. I mean, I've actually caught associates lying. I never really thought about disciplining them this way, but maybe I should consider it. All associates right. out there, beware.
Beware. Gina Martini.
This guy made a terrible lawyer, but a great criminal, huh? Because just thinking about it. Okay. So the next topic up for discussion today, lawyers versus Valentine's Day.
You're on Burgundy?
Yeah, we've got actually some great Valentine's Day stories, but we have another one actually that just, it's literally breaking now. It's rapper Y. I want to get this straight because Tina is the pro with all the rappers.
Oh, yeah.
No,
yeah.
21 Savage, we were going to cover that story. That. We didn't have time for that because YNW Melly is charged with murder. Raise your hand if you know the music of Y.
Musical stylings of Y. No.
Melly Jeff.
Hasn't made it to my Spotify.
But no, he's apparently an up-and-coming hip-hop artist in Florida, part of the emerging Florida thriving hip-hop scene. I'm not just reading that from a piece of paper, by the way. That's just,
he's experienced it firsthand.
Yeah, he recently collaborated with Kanye West. His first official studio album is called We All Shine, was just released. And yesterday... is alleged to have shot two of his close friends dead and then help another man try to make it look like they were the victims of a drive-by shooting. This happened down in Miramar, Florida. YNW Melly's legal name is Jamel Demons. He was arrested and again charged with these two counts of first-degree murder. He's 19 years old, and he has a court hearing scheduled today. And, of course, has alleged already in the press that he is not guilty. His post says, a lot of rumors and lies are being said, but no worries. God is with me and my brother. And we all want you to remember it's a YNW family. It seems like God is, you know, generally not there at
seems
the,
like
at the first part
demons.
Of it. But,
he has some demons. Isn't his last name Demons?
Yeah, exactly. Tina, are you going to get rid of all your YNW Melly
I have a lot
cassettes?
Of memory. Yeah, I was going to say, I've got it on A-Track. I've got it on cassette. And I think that it's about time I put it in a box and stick it on the curbside.
Yeah.
But it seems like once these guys have some bad acts, it does nothing but promote their career.
Right? Oh,
so,
yeah.
Like, how do we make it so this hurts?
True, yeah.
Well, and the rapper community seems to be really impacted by a lot of this. You know, I just remember Tupac getting shot many years ago. I remember that's like the first of these that I really remember just being so huge and just, you know, really impacting music and people's sensitivity to the violence, and it's unfortunate.
Yeah, definitely a serious crime. Jeff, do you think that sometimes the media picks up on these stories because of the notoriety of who's involved? I mean, obviously, it's a big story because he's a rapper. Probably wouldn't hear about it here in Chicago if he wasn't.
I think a lot of it comes down to a lot of these individuals, their social media presence. So some editor somewhere sees that this person has 50,000 followers, and then there are 10,000 tweets around this, and then they jump on it and they say, well, someone's interested here, and that whole idea of clickbait and trying to get all the push to your website. I think that's why we wind up seeing more of these kind of obscure stories about people that, like you said, otherwise it would just be some guy who shot his friends, you know, and going to jail or being arrested.
But I can tell you, back when they had the Notorious B.I.G. thing, you know, I didn't even know who he was. I'm embarrassed to say this. Did I just say that on a mic? When I had to read that story, when I had to first read that story, I thought it was Notorious Big. And I had to have somebody correct me. So a lot of these guys are kind of obscure at first, maybe.
Yeah, well. Killing two people probably changes that in a hurry. All right, let's move on to our last story, everyone. This is, as promised, for our Valentine's Day special. These are some lawsuits involving Valentine's Day. So one that we found involved a couple who sued a school district when the school refused to allow their son to distribute Valentine's Day cards to his class. They had religious notes written on them, and they claimed that this violated their First Amendment rights of free speech. Tina? Taking it a little too far? What do you think?
I think it's taking it a little bit too far.
The religious part is what obviously makes it a little different, right? They claim that he was allowed to express freedom of religion, but maybe not the best use of the legal system.
I think there are other things we need to attend to first.
Char?
Yeah, so I'm actually running for my school district board of education right now, and we were recently in a meeting thinking about, you know, the applicability of religious freedoms in schools and talking through some of those issues. And, I think there are better things to be done with the legal system as well as our school system than pursue these types of lawsuits, because, frankly, that's not why the students are there. That's not why the teachers are there, taking up school time and then suing because you don't have the opportunity to pass out your religious messaging is definitely taking it too far, in my opinion.
Well said. So, Pam, there's another case involving a male supervisor, who was found to violate his store's sexual harassment policy because he gave his female supervisor a greeting card, a stuffed animal, and a box of chocolates for Valentine's Day. Is this taken to the extreme, you think?
Wow.
Or what are your thoughts on that?
Depends on the history of these two. You know, I would say it depends on what's happened before, because this doesn't come out of nowhere. I don't think this comes out of nowhere.
Well, there's an additional fact. The card. The card. Wait a second.
El Razor is coming out with what the additional fact is.
Well, they alleged that there was sexually expressive material in the card because when you open it, it played Let's Spend the Night Together by the Rolling Stones.
I don't know that song.
Uh-huh. Jeff? Crossing the line?
Yeah, I think that's crossing the
Would
line.
Would you ever hand a female coworker a card that says, Let's Spend the Night Together?
No.
Probably a little
absolutely
bit.
Absolutely not.
Char, you deal with these issues in your role as general counsel. Obviously, times have changed, especially in light of the Me Too movement and relations between coworkers is understandably so and rightfully so, more sensitive than it ever has been. And we cover these stories all the time when it comes to Halloween, Christmas. These are holidays that are fraught with potential litigation. What are your thoughts, and how do you counsel your company to avoid problems like this?
So I think common sense, unfortunately, is not all that common sometimes. So we need to remind people in the workplace not to be handing out their teddy bears stuffed with love notes to the folks that they manage or work with. So I think best practice for me today was that I start and end my day with you know, taking that piece of advice for myself. And I saved my teddy bears and heart-shaped candy grams for home. But also just having some increased sensitivity, as you mentioned. We all have to think about how we engage each other in the workplace and how we also reach across and engage our male and female colleagues and have appropriate meetings and lunch sessions where information can be exchanged, but do it in a professional way where there is no misunderstanding and there's no misconception of, you know, a romantic advance.
Tina.
Why are you looking at
Well, because I thought for sure you were going to bring me a stuffed animal today.
You know, I was wondering if I was going to get that, you know, that heart-shaped box of chocolate, Rich.
On Legal Face-Off, we have no sexual harassment policy. So, as we know from some prior guests, they violated them all day. So
that's hilarious.
I will accept a stuffed animal from you, Tina. How about worst, any bad Valentine's Day stories?
There's a great
bad dates, bad dinners, bad presents.
I don't have a personal one, but it's a legal story.
Yeah, we love
that. In 2015, there's a woman in Portland who famously made a reservation for herself and her husband, and the husband had too much at lunch, so he was full and he didn't want to go to dinner, so she went alone. And she sat down, and the waitress came up to her and said, "Well, is your other half coming here? One of those kind of fancy Valentine's Day is busy. We want to turn our tables kind of thing."
Mm-hmm.
And the woman said, "No, it's just going to be me. He's not going to be able to make it." And the waiter said, "Oh, you've got to go. You know, this is two tables. We have two seats. We need someone to be here." And so the woman turned around and sued for $100,000, saying that it ruined her Valentine's
Day. Emotional distress.
Right. And so,
seriously?
And yeah, I think they ended up settling for an undisclosed amount of money. But the fact that she sued for that much money, I thought was, wow. I mean, I've had some terrible Valentine's Days, but never $100,000 worth
you
of damage.
You wouldn't take it to court, huh?
No.
I see a lot of cases. You see a lot of cases. Actually, there was a firm I know in Chicago a couple of years ago where an attorney sued her fiancé. They broke off the engagement, and there was litigation involving the presents for the showers mm-hmm. and the ring. You see that kind of litigation all the mm-hmm. time, you know?
Yeah, you do.
Who keeps the ring? Do you give it back?
I think...
What's the story there?
I think that...
Give it back?
Give it back.
Yeah, I think you give it
don't
back.
Don't keep it?
Mm-mm.
What if you don't,
no,
what if you don't give
jail.
It? What if you keep it? Could the other side sue you for that? Conversion? Yeah. Some kind of...
You know, you hope it doesn't get to that, yeah. But I mean, I just think that the appropriate thing to do is to return the ring, especially if the ring has some sort of familial,
Now if it's an heirloom
connection, like if it's an heirloom of the almost groom's family,
that I get.
I would say you return it.
I have an ex-boyfriend from high school's grandmother's engagement ring.
Oh, wow. You still have it?
I still have it, but he knows that I intend to return it. I was bitter back then. I was real bitter. Mm-hmm, real bitter.
That's a long IOU.
Right?
Yeah.
What's the statute of limitations on that, I wonder?
I don't think he'll be suing me. I have too much dirt on him. No. All right, so... Do you have any Valentine's Day
Rich.
Horror stories?
You got horror
you
stories?
You heartbreaker.
Too many to disclose on the air. Way too many.
Driving that Nissan around.
Yeah, exactly.
Be a real chick magnet.
That's right. The razor in the car.
I mean, I would say one of the wackier stories I've got is, getting flowers from people that you just don't expect to get them from.
Yeah.
And with notes, sometimes you're like, wow, where did that come from?
Stalkers. Like, Legal Face-Off stalkers.
Like a guy I bought a car from once sent me flowers and, you know, asked me out. And I'm like, I just bought a car from you. I didn't think this was going to go anywhere.
I had that happen.
Really?
I think I had that happen.
I think that's the first rule of car dealer playbook.
Really?
Yeah. Oh, yeah.
Well, see,
I'm sure that's all over the place.
Selling you a car? Now let's make out.
Wow. That is really, really slimy.
Not too much.
I'm feeling like I need a shower. All right. That's it for a Legal Face-Off. Big thanks to all of our guests who showed up today. Bob, Kate, Jennifer, and of course, our hosts, Tina and Rich. Thank you so much. This is Pam Jones, and we're here with Legal Face-Off. Keep joining us.
Thanks, and thanks to Char and our friend Jeff.
And Jeff.
Thank you.
Thanks, guys.
Thanks, everyone.
Thanks for having us.
It's Christina Martini and Rich Linkoff. You know what time it is. Welcome to Legal Face-Off. Two lawyers trading jab for jab. So hit them up with any questions you have. WGN Radio, we blowing up your stereo. Got a question, just pick up the phone and they'll let you know. Covering sports, Hollywood, and don't forget the politics. It don't get no better than this. Now, courtroom combat going hand to hand.